Blog Talk Radio.
Hi and welcome to Rave Reviews Book Club, Rave Waves on Blog Talk Radio Show, Beyond the Cover. I'm your host, Liz Gavin. Today's show is being sponsored by Slivers of Life by author Bing Weeks. If you want to join in the conversation today, just go on Twitter and use the hashtag RRBC Beyond the Cover. That's hashtag RRBC Beyond the Cover. And send your questions to our very special guest today, Jen Hockey, chatting with us about from the United Kingdom. She is an amazingly supportive member of the and a very talented author. Her book is Milele Safari, An Eternal Journey. Thank you for coming on the show today, Jen.
My pleasure.
It's so nice
to
have
you. Invited.
Thanks. So let's start talking about your book a little bit. That is an interesting story, in fact, about the title, Jen. Could you tell us how and why you chose it?
Okay. Well, safari is a Swahili word meaning journey, although it's come to be more associated with wildlife tourism in Asia and in Africa. The book actually started out as the Safari Tales, as I was approaching it more as a kind of short story anthology with an African theme, but a bit along the lines of the Canterbury Tales, which is also about a journey, of course. When I was finally ready to go to print, a good friend pointed out to me that Safari Tales sounded too much like what I did on my holidays kind of title, so I had to rethink it, but I still needed to include the word safari. So I went to good old Google Translate and found that the Swahili word for forever or eternal is milele. So I had the main title and the subtitle for Milele Safari, An Eternal Journey. And I really like the word milele because it sounds really musical and very African.
Mm-hmm, definitely, yeah. And also there is a connection between a safari and the way you wrote your story, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, it's basically... It turned into a kind of life journey for one of the characters, certainly, and we sort of dragged the other ones in with her as well. So, I mean, literally, safari as a word means any sort of journey. It doesn't mean going around looking at animals or shooting them. It means that you're going on a journey from A to B, and we all do that by living our lives.
I also understand that there are conflicts and personal dramas depicted in your book that can be found anywhere in the world, really, because they are universal themes. In my opinion, this is one of the reasons your book is so touching and readers get so moved by your story, in fact. Could you please tell us why you chose Africa for the setting?
Well, I've been there a lot with my husband and his brother and wife for holidays, but it really sort of began as a safari in its sort of wildlife sense back when I was a child, because I used to love those sort of wildlife programs on the BBC that they do so well, and I sort of fell in love with Africa before I ever went there. I was about just in my early 30s when I went there, and it really just bowled me over. I loved it and loved the people that I met there, and that's why I decided to base it in Africa. And then as life goes on, as you do, and I had all sorts of other experiences through work and things where I was falling ill and needed to retire early. Through work, I faced various challenges, such as a breakdown, and also I used to work in the court service, which meant I was working with children who had been abused in various ways,
mm-hmm.
which kind of cuts into some of the storylines that I included in the book. So life experience and also nice memories of happy holidays and beautiful scenes, that kind of thing.
Yeah, this is so true when you're reading the book. I mean, this heavy but also very important issues that you, especially the kids being mistreated, and they are such a sad victims of violence and struggle in that part of the world, isn't it?
That's right, yes. I mean, certainly I wasn't intending to write about something as serious and awful as genocide or famine and disease. But the whole point was to sort of get a sort of holistic overview of life in Africa, warts and all. And so I was able to draw on experience that had happened there or in other places that sort of fitted into the theme. With, you mentioned the little girl who grew up to be one of the core characters around whom the story's based, who was a child at the time of the Biafran War and famine. And her sort of torture scenes and her actual backstory were based in Biafra, but I also brought in other elements of certainly women and young girls' experiences in African conflicts where there are war crimes that are specifically directed towards women and fertility and basically trying to eradicate, as in the case of genocide, a tribe, people, a race of people who, for one reason or another, have become hated or loathed for whatever reason.
Yeah.
The serious
but
stuff. But
on the other... Sorry. on the other hand, your book leaves us with a good feeling. I mean, it's heavy. It's hard to read, as you yourself put it. But it's also about hope and love and overcoming hard situations,
yeah.
isn't it?
Yes, very much
you,
so. I think the latter stages of the book, I sort of got to a place in the middle of the book where I was sort of writing about the nicer aspects of being in Africa and the whole sort of more the tourist side of things, but also how they were touching on the lives of real people. And so one of my main characters, Sophie, because of her past, she's had to rethink how she wants to live her life and decides to become a doctor. And she's actually come back to Africa to take up a practice in a new village community to help victims of a past conflict. And so I wanted to show how she'd actually come to that decision to actually come back, even though she was had so many bad memories of it. She still wanted to come back, and she also, in a way, falls in love with Africa again, and then meets this glamorous young vet at Lake Kariba and falls head over heels for him very quickly. So there's all sorts of threads in there about leaving the past behind you and looking for hope, and that's also carried through to the Africans that they meet in Gakera, which is the community that Sophie's going to help with. The people there are recovering from terrible experiences, and they also find hope, helped by Sophie, but also by themselves and how they've overcome what they've done in the past.
Yeah.
So positive things.
Exactly. So to what extent did you use your own personal experiences to create your story? I mean, you've mentioned that you've visited Africa, but only as a tourist, or have you ever lived there?
I've not actually lived there, but I know people who do live there. And my husband used to be a travel agent, and he at one time he spent about a month or two out there with a friend that he'd made who ran a safari tourist company, and he actually worked in the camps for a while. So I'm taking from his experience, and also from another friend that I've met online who used to work in South Africa and took a course in game guiding. So I've incorporated some of their experience in that. A lot of the on safari things, like the little birds that Sophie loves on the lake, the malachite kingfisher, she's always raving about how she wants to see them again, and they've got to go and see these little birds flying around. And that was actually my husband who actually fell in love with these little tiny birds. They're basically not even as long as your finger, and they're exactly like kingfishers, and very, very hard to photograph because they're so quick and so small. So you've got to creep up on them very slowly and gently, and not frighten them so that you can take a photograph of them. So that they're in there. It's a bit near the end where Sophie gets bitten by a bot fly, which is a very nasty fly, obviously, who lay their eggs in wet washing. And so she gets bitten by this bot fly and has to have her boyfriend tweeze the maggot out of her back. And that actually happened to me at one camp where we didn't have time, I thought, to get our clothes laundered. So I very foolishly did my own, left them out to dry. And lo and behold, I too got bitten. And I too had to have a little maggot tweezed out of my stomach by candlelight in our tent by my husband.
Okay.
That was true love.
Okay. Also, your ability to develop characters is something outstanding, especially for a debut novel. And I'm not alone in this, because many of the reviewers pointed out the same quality in your book. So I've got to ask, is Milele Safari your first attempt as a writer?
Not attempt. I mean, I've been writing to please myself for some time, but on and off. Working in the courts, you sometimes have to prepare little speeches to actually bring on a case in court. I'm the person who's sitting in front of the judge taking notes, kind of thing. So I have to bring on the case, and that involves some writing ability. So what I find most challenging at first as a writer was actually doing dialogue. But in 2005, I had to take early retirement, and I joined a role-playing website, which was a forum for Tolkien fans when the films came out in the beginning of 2000. And I did a lot of role play in pen and paper rather than online and gaming type of role play. And I found that gradually my writing of dialogue in particular improved quite a lot, because I was, in a way, I was acting out characters with other people, obviously. And that did actually help me a lot with the sort of procedure of actually writing it as if people are talking rather than how you think they're talking. But really, I think mostly you learn how to write by reading great writers like Mike Tolkien, Rudyard Kipling, Jane Austen, William Faulkner, Terry Pratchett, and Wilbur Smith. Wilbur Smith's stuff's lovely because it's about Africa, but also he's a thriller writer, and I don't really like thrillers that much. It's not really a genre that I appreciate too much, but I really love his books. So it's getting that in your head and how things should work when you're writing really well, and those are all obviously good examples of great writers. So I've got that to fall back on. And the main thing, though, with writing as a whole is to read it back to yourself very slowly, and preferably, if you can, read it out loud, or in my case, whisper it, because my voice breaks up very easily. And I don't like having an audience when I'm doing that either, so I tend to whisper things to myself to make sure that they sound right, even the narrative. And it sounds natural, like the way that somebody would be telling you a story rather than you reading it.
Yeah, okay, got that. And how long did it take you to finish Mileli?
Mileli, oh, goodness. Well, I actually started writing it way, way back in the early 90s. And that was actually the second chapter, which is called Watching, which is about the leopard. And I wrote it about the leopard rather than as the leopard, which is how it's actually turned out in the end. But that was something that happened on safari, and I just basically wrote it as a straight story of people in the safari bus watching this leopard and her two cubs. But then as time went on, I left it. I wasn't thinking about publishing or anything. I just wanted to write the story. As it went on, I gradually wanted to, with the sort of, as it was coalescing in my head, I wanted to tell the story from all kinds of points of view. And so I thought, well, why not write it from the leopard's point of view? So I did. And that brought in the sort of experience of the animals and the effect that tourism has on them, kind of thing. So it's a bit of a hodgepodge of different approaches, but I do enjoy actually sort of switching the approach, if you like, and putting in a mix of styles, so that it's like everything in life is like a kaleidoscope, so everything's constantly changing, and you hear different accents and tones. So I wanted to actually sort of incorporate that kind of thing in the book, so that you get a sort of an impression of different scenes and views and that kind of thing.
Yeah, that comes to my next question, really, because I was going to ask you about different points of view in a story. This is always one of the trickiest parts in writing, I mean, keeping a different point of views. And how did you manage to combine those different, including animals' point of view?
Including the animals, yes. I think it's the acting thing again, and the role play is putting yourself in the head of the person that is giving the detail and the story. So the main thing is to try and keep your storyline straight and simple. And some people do find that confusing to read. I have one 3-star review who liked the book but couldn't get on with all the shifting of characters' voices. But I thought that I had made it as simple as I could, in a way, because I tried to keep it to one chapter for one point of view, and also to use things like italics for the parts that are about flashbacks, so that you, if you're reading something in italics, it's a flashback, and if it's not italics, then it's happening now kind of thing for the character. So that was the sort of technique that I adopted, a sort of combination of that, plus journals as well, journal entries, mainly by Sophie, but also by Teresa Olatunde, who's the character who's actually dead in the whole book, but her past has affected everyone else. But, I mean, I think the person who actually does points of view best, of course, is George Martin with the Song of Fire and Ice and Game of Thrones, obviously. How he keeps all his strands of stories straight is just amazing, because he's got about 50 point of view characters now. And he does actually tend to keep them to one chapter each. And that was something that definitely helped me to sort of discipline, keep it as disciplined as I wanted to with my book.
True. Yeah, true. Personally, as a reader, I like to know what's going on in other characters' minds, you know. But yeah, as a writer, it is a challenge. So congratulations, because you did that very well.
Thank you very much. The hardest one to do was the one for Verity and David, the Africans who had come through the genocide conflict. And because they shared a lot of scenes together, so I was actually writing from two perspectives at once in a way, with sort of his memories, her memories coming in. So that was a hard chapter to write. And also, because I've never been through anything like that myself, although I could understand some of the sort of mental effects of it and the trauma, it was very hard to actually get inside their heads. And to some extent, my role play from the fantasy forums did help a little with that, because I have got to be quite good at doing battle scenes and having people die. And also, I have role played Sauron, the baddie in Lord of the Rings. I've role played him a couple of times, and he definitely did help with channeling the evil aspect of things.
True, yeah. Your family also played an important role during the writing of your book, as you put in your foreword. Could you tell us more about that process, and why did you decide to publish independently? So tell us about the process of putting the book together with the help of your family, and why you decide to publish independently.
Okay. My parents were both beta readers for me, basically. My father not so much, because he actually died before I'd written the first third of it. I think I had about four or five chapters in the bag before he died. But he actually did read it, and he had been a soldier. And he said he found it very moving how I wrote about the Biafran conflict and the actual sort of scenes in Africa where people are killed. He thought that they were good, and he also liked the leopard story. And he was quite a pivotal influence on my life in terms of love of animals, basically. He always loved dogs and things like that, but he was the one who always insisted on watching these lovely wildlife shows on television. And we sort of grew up in a house that was full of books about African animals and Asian animals, horses. We seemed to be surrounded by animals a lot, so he was one of the main influences for the inspiration behind it, if you like. And my mum, too, she was very encouraging about reading and writing. She was quite proud, because I used to win prizes in school for writing. Then I got married, and my husband was a travel agent. He arranged all these lovely trips for us to amazing places, so that, again, fed into the background of it all. But really, from the actual sort of writing side of things, it was generally them sort of cheering on from the sidelines and saying, yeah, this is great, keep on doing it, don't stop. Although I was writing very slowly, I started writing in earnest in about 2008, just before my father became very ill. And I actually took it into hospital for him to read while he was having, before he was actually having radiotherapy. And that's when he sort of came into it. So I decided then this has got to be published. And I was getting to grips more with the new storyline where it was not going to be short stories anymore. It was going to be a really sort of pulled together thing. And from there on, after he died, I kept on writing, and my mum wanted to read it as well. So she was always sort of, when's the next part ready? Come on, come on. So that, from that point of view, I was getting a lot of support and encouragement. My husband was encouraging in practical ways, like not making a fuss when I was up at 3 o'clock in the morning writing, and making me cups of tea, and have me ignoring him at the other end of the room on the computer while he's watching television. He did read some of it, but he's one of these people who is very oriented to visual things and not to actual reading. So he never actually read anything but the first few chapters, which he thought was heavy going. So I didn't actually get any literary feedback from him so much, but basically I couldn't have done it without him being able to be there to support me through all the hard bits and saying, you can do it, kind of thing. For the self-published route, basically I'm getting old and I'm not in the best of physical health. I have chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder, which is means I get very breathless quite easily and can't exercise a lot as a result of that. So mortality kicked in, I think, and I'm actually still in my late 50s, but some days I feel older and I feel, you know, that I need to get on and finish it. So that helped. But I also can't handle rejection too well. So I was very, very selective about looking into agents and publishing houses. And the main reason for that was also because primarily I'm more comfortable writing about fantasy, and there is fantasy in the book, although not very much of it. The folklore parts certainly are there, and that's my background. So I knew that eventually I would be wanting to write fantasy rather than contemporary novels. So I was looking at houses who specialise in fantasy or sci-fi. And a lot of them in the UK certainly don't seem to like taking on authors in those two genres too much. That ruled out quite a few of them who weren't taking submissions in those fields, even though I had a different book. But with the agents, I certainly had to sort of look into their background and see what they were dealing with. And I actually came up with about half a dozen that I decided, well, these look as if they might suit me. And so I worked away to all of them, and I heard back from three, all negatively. And then I thought, well, what do I do now? Do I carry on looking? Because I had a jolly good look last time. I looked through hundreds and hundreds of websites and lists from the library. We have these great big books that have a directory of agents for authors, kind of thing. So I thought, no, let's try and do it myself, because I've worked in publishing in my career and for a government department, writing annual reports and like brochure reports, leaflets, forms, that kind of thing. So I actually had software that is industry standard, and I can use things like Photoshop and Adobe Illustrator and things like that, because I also do graphic design. So I decided that, well, you've got the skills, you've got the software, you can do this yourself. And that's where you fall into the trap of thinking that you don't need a good editor, because you do. But luckily, I have found a very good friend on my fantasy forum who was an academic author for Tolkien scholars, and she'd also had a book published herself, and she also had taught creative writing. So I'm just looking at the time, we were running out, aren't we? She's my editor, basically, and she was wonderful. So do it yourself. Best thing there is.
I'm sorry, we ran out of time. And so thank you again, Jen. And thanks, everybody, for listening in. And stay tuned
next Thursday, May 14th, with John Fioravanti. Thank you, Jen.
Thank you.
Tragedy and fulfillment, love and hate, loss and renewal, running the gamut of human emotion, Slivers of Life by Bean Weeks tackles issues as diverse as Alzheimer's disease and civil rights, young love and tragic death. In the capable hands of skilled author Weeks, the 20 short stories contained within Slivers of Life become a journey, often leading readers into strange and dark corners. Slivers of Life has been called thought-provoking and often skatingly witty, sometimes devastating, but never dull. Pick up this highly praised collection of short stories today as an e-book or in paperback. Slivers of Life by Bean Weeks. Everybody has a story to tell, and no two are ever exactly alike. If you'd like to know how you can get your own live commercial read on one of our shows, please visit ravereviewsbynannyjules.wordpress.com and click the Rave Waves tab.